This recording is a production of Faith Builders Educational Programs. This presentation was recorded at Teachers Week 2016, held at Faith Builders on August 1 through 5.
Okay, well, thank you for coming. My name is Lyle Musser, and my experience is with mostly with 7th and 8th grade students. As far as a classroom, I also served as principal or administrator for the last 10 years as well. At our school, so I've kind of been on a sliding scale of in the classroom all the time to not being in the classroom at all this coming school year. But most of my direct instruction, communication with students comes from the 7th and 8th grade level or range of students. So this morning we want to try to look at a big picture view and then whittle down to some very specific character traits that we can be looking for in our classrooms. And something that was helpful for us as a school when we refer to it as the front side of the report card and the back side of the report card. So the back side of the report card, we try to assess particular character traits that we believe are important in our students' lives. And we got quite a bit of help from this book. And I think the newer version has a different title, With All Due Respect, by Ronald G. Moorish. And the helpful part of this book is in the back. There is an appendix called Appendix B. And it gives these little charts with grade appropriate or grade level appropriate behaviors and defines some things very specifically. You know, how long should a fourth grade student be able to work without interrupting others or having to ask the teacher a question? How long should that seventh or eighth grade student be able to stay on task and occupy themselves without bugging their neighbor or having to ask the teacher a question? And so this book was very helpful in the formation of what we do as a school, and we'll look at that a little bit later, but we want to get a big picture view of what I call the three dimensions of judgment. So, since I'm not a PowerPoint kind of guy and don't bother with that technology, we made a very crude example, and we want to look, just kind of frame what we're talking about here this morning. I know we live in a three-dimensional world, okay? And even in Mark's prayer, he mentioned time. God gave us this time and this space. So when we think about our world, the world that we live in, it truly is three-dimensional. And I try to explain this to my 7th and 8th graders, that I believe there are three dimensions of judgment. There are eyes that look down. That's God's view of my actions. There's eyes that look across. That's how others view my actions and how I treat them. And then there are eyes that look inward. So if we think about some of the things in our world that are three-dimensional or have some type of threeness about them, there's space, and that's why I use the box. Space is probably the most obvious one. You start teaching your students about length, width, and height. I would say in the, probably the third, fourth grade level. And so we have length, width, and height. Those are the three dimensions. And without getting too technical, those are the only three that we know of. So space is three-dimensional. Time is, in some sense, three-dimensional. We have the past, the present, and the future. And we've broken it down into three portions. We also have matter. We've broken down into the smallest units, and it's been a long time since I taught science, but it's protons, neutrons, and electrons. So somehow people have liked to describe the main things around us, time, matter, space, in terms of three basic elements. And even God is described as a trinity. There's a threeness: God the Father, God the Son, God the Holy Spirit. And so this concept of three dimensions, I try to apply to other things in life, to hopefully help our students make a connection, real-world connection to who they are. So here we have our student who is existing inside of their world. They are doing the things that they do. They're acting the way that they act. And in all of these things that are happening in this young lady's world, my daughter asked if she should be a lady or a man, and I said a man first of all, and she said, well, that's harder. So I said, make her a lady. So all the things that she does here in her little world, there are eyes that look down, and God is assessing what happens when this young lady does what she does. And also, there's a reciprocal effect to each of these arrows, but that would have made it more complicated. So, you know, God looks down, but we also have a certain obligation response this direction towards God. There's certain motivation for us when we look towards God and what does He desire or require of us. We have the eyes that look across, and so when this young lady does her actions and does what she does in her little world, there are eyes that look across. Her friends observe what she does, and there's this impact that her actions have on them and that they have on her. And so there's this side-to-side type relationship. And then there's also the inward focus here, which is, you know, how, what do my actions reflect about me? Jesus says all of our actions spring from our hearts. They come out of us. And so what do her actions say about her heart? Okay, what does it say about that inward focus, or that you could call it the outward focus? What do my actions reveal about my heart? And so, in a big picture way, I think we want to promote to students this concept that my actions aren't just about me, myself, and I. God assesses, others see, and it tells me something. The way that I act tells me something about myself. And so that's the big picture concept or idea that we want to look at here. We're going to go to this overhead now and work down through this concept of the three dimensions of judgment. When I talk to high school students about this, I called it three dimensions of judgment. When I talk to my younger students, I talk about three eyes on my actions. And so just a number of verses here, you don't necessarily have to look them up, but maybe sometimes stating the obvious. Can you flip the front light off? Everyone see that okay? The overheads at Faith Builders don't get used as much as they used to, and I can tell that by the dust that's right up here. So anyhow, I had intentions of cleaning it and didn't get around to it. Okay, so first of all, the eyes that look down. And this is the most important, I think, for us, no matter the age of the student, to bring to bear on their conscience, on their heart, on their daily lives, the fact that God is an observer of what is happening here. And God saw what you just did to Susie. God saw what you just did to Sammy. And so the eyes of the Lord are in every place, beholding the evil and the good. So we're talking about my response to God, God's law, and God's leadership in my life. And we'll see this in a more distinct way when we get to the character chart that I'll hand out in a little bit. Okay, so the idea here is simply that God sees. It's something that we know, but our students need to know that as well. Okay, they need to hear that from us on a regular and repeated basis. God sees. Jeremiah 32:19 says, "Great in counsel and mighty in work, for thine eyes are open upon all the ways of the sons of men, to give everyone according to his ways and according to the fruit of his doing." Now, the idea of this verse is that God assesses. Okay, God assesses. He looks. Okay, his eyes are open upon all the ways of the sons of men. So God observes, he looks, but he's not some neutral party. He makes an assessment about that, and he chalks it up as in his way of judging things, he has something particular to say about how that student was acting. They need to understand that. They need to know that. So God not only assesses, but then he pays for fruit. Now, this is fairly obvious. If you ask your students, if they have any kind of farming background, what do you get paid for if you're a farmer? It's the things that you produce, okay? And so the concept of sowing and reaping here can be explained to them at a very young level. God not only sees, he assesses, and he pays. And what he pays for is fruit, and he pays for good fruit. 1 Peter 5 and verse 5, likewise, ye younger, submit yourselves unto the elder. Yea, and all of you be subject one to another and be clothed with humility, for God resisteth the proud and gives grace to the humble. And so this verse is excellent because it gives a number of characteristics, character qualities that we see that God approves of, and they are to submit, to be subject, they are humility, and of course, God gives grace to the humble. The humble are the ones who receive his grace. And so looking at the positive aspect of this verse here, we can say to our students, we know for sure these are some of the characteristics that God, character qualities that God would like to see in your life. And the nice thing about that is that you can tell them with great confidence that God wants to see these characteristics in their life because you've showed it to them in his word. You never want to get yourself in a situation where you're standing on your own authority because it's about you and how they've offended you. We have to bear in mind that we stand as a teacher in place of the parents, drawing our students into that relationship with God as a parent would do in their parenting. And so don't get yourself in the way here and say you need to submit to me and be subject to me because I said so. No, it's because God says so. Now, there is an alternate attitude here. God resists the proud. And so the negative side of this verse here, or the downside, is that there is an alternate attitude that receives God's resistance. And so the idea of God giving grace to the humble, God receives, or God gives his smile of approval and favor to this humble attitude. And our students can be assured that they don't want to receive God's resistance, okay? They know, they understand that if God is resisting them, they're not going to get very far. You can bring this into your science lesson too when you talk about friction and those kinds of things. Bring it all together for them. Hebrews 13:12, obey them that have the rule over you and submit yourselves, for they watch for your souls as they that must give account, that they may do it with joy and not with grief, for that is unprofitable for you. And so the first two verses here that we looked at talk about directly our response to God and how God is assessing our actions. The next two talk about God's leadership and God's direction to those and to us to be under leadership, appropriately taking our place. And so it's not proudful or arrogant for you to remind your students that you have responsibility to them, because you do have the rule over them, okay? That you do have this responsibility. You are those who have a rule over them, and you must give account for how they act. Now, it depends what age, and this account, hopefully, can be done with joy and not with grief. Now, if you're talking with students, I like to think of students, young students need discipline, okay? They need to be told what is right, what is wrong. It needs to be very direct, easy to understand. Punishment needs to follow, you know, their transgressions. And then as they get older, you enter into more of a coaching type of relationship where hopefully they can see you as an ally. How can Mr. So-and-so help me? And so ideally you would get to the point where possibly in junior high and high school, you have a student that's mature enough that would come to you and say, you know what, Mr. Sam, whatever your name is, I want you to give this account to me. Okay. The scripture says that you have to give an account. Tell me, what would your account look like? Okay. If you had to give your account to God for me, what would that look like now? And I think as teachers, as we're bringing them up and into the older years, we should be willing to be honest with them about what that account should look like, nor should it be some secret to them. If they want to know, we should be able to give them an account, because that can be a great benefit to them. If they come asking, make sure your account doesn't go automatically to the negative. Okay, I think you understand this as teachers. Make sure your list has some of both sides on. And on that aspect, it may be Mr. Goody that comes to ask for the account because he wants a boost to his pride. So even if there isn't much bad to look at, you should counter that with something that can be worked on. Okay, so giving account, that's our duty, and we want to do it with joy and not with grief. And it would be great if we would have that relationship with our students that we could give that account directly to them and say, you know what, if I had to answer to God for you, if I had to give my account, this is what it would be. Okay, those are the eyes that look down. Eyes that look across, thinking about a response to others. And this is, being in the school setting, this possibly is one that, because of the social aspect of school, is maybe the greatest challenge. We all understand what peer pressure is, and this is where peer pressure would play in. So what is my response to others? Thinking about those beside me. When Susie does her actions in her world, what does that say to the others, and how does that impact the others? Luke 6:23, do to others as you would have them do to you. I use the NIV here because it follows more closely to what we think of as a golden rule. Do to others as you would have them do to you. Now, this is something that can be taught at a very young age, but even at an older age, do we sufficiently put ourselves in the shoes of others? Too often we are moving through life and something comes up and it's a distraction and an annoyance, and you just want Sammy and Joe to get along, and so you do something to make them get along temporarily right now because class is important and we have things to do and places to go. But stopping to sufficiently analyze and say, you know what, Joe, Sammy, whatever took place here, I want you to put yourself in the other shoes. Do we, you know, the golden rule is so simple, but do we actually take the time to apply that and to actually put ourselves in the shoes of the other and think about how that came to him the way I gave it to him? And this can be done at a very young age, but it applies just as well to those of us that are older. Okay, to us, we do what we do because we think we know what should be done, but we really don't stop often enough to think about how it came across to the other person. Romans 14 and verse 19, a great verse. Let us therefore follow after the things which make for peace and the things wherewith we may edify one another. And so, if you're a new teacher, you'll figure this out. If you've been teaching, you know this. Sometimes you get into a situation with students where it's ambiguous, okay? It is not clear. It might not even be clear what happened on the playground. And you don't know what to do, okay? You don't know who should serve the consequences. You don't know who was the initiator, who drummed up this wrong to be done to another person. But one of the big picture things here is that when our students are acting in the way that they should, the end result is going to be peace and that there's going to be edification. In other words, when Susie is doing the things that Susie does in her little world, the result of that, that God desires, is that her actions result in peace. Her actions result in the fact that others are built up, edified, that they're encouraged and blessed. And too often in our social groups, that is not the case. You can have a certain number of them that think they're at peace, but you can have one that certainly wasn't edified. And you have, you know, five that went away laughing and they had a good time and they're perfectly at peace, but the one that they put down instead of edified is left alone. Okay, and so how do you address those types of things, you know, cliques and all of that? It's never cut and dried. It's always sticky, but here are some principles that we can promote to our students. You know what? When you're done doing what you're doing and you're out at recess and you fourth grade girls, the end result after recess, everyone should be at peace with each other. And everything that was done out there should have been done so that all of you are built up, that there's not this one that was left out, put down, and goes away discouraged. And of course, our mouths, Ephesians 4:29, our mouths get us in trouble much too often. Let no corrupt communication proceed out of your mouth, but that which is good to the use of edifying, that it may minister grace unto the hearers. And so a great principle for us to apply first as a teacher, because we use our mouths probably more than our students, and we get to say what we want to say, and we tell them when they're allowed to speak and all of that. But the idea here is that we let our words fly from our mouth, and too few of us actually stop and think about how that entered the hearer's ears, because we know what we wanted to say and we thought about how we wanted to say it, and so we just say it the way we said it and we assume that the other person heard it the way that we said it. And you know that in social relationships and in students who are learning, still learning to communicate clearly, that that doesn't always happen. And so here's a great principle to promote to your students. When you speak, you know that you've said the right thing if the person that you're speaking to was edified. They were built up. It did something good for them. It was a blessing to them, and it ministered grace to them. They found a blessing in what you said to them. And so this is a foundational principle from Scripture as to how we relate to others, the eyes that look across. This verse is also a great verse to go to. If you ever encounter swearing in your school, you know, and okay, then it's big, bad, and awful, right? And so someone used a swear word, and you can come back to this verse and say, you know what, students? The reason that swearing is wrong is because there's a set of words that cannot ever be used to do these things, okay? It's not possible. But guess what, students? There are plenty of words. There's all kinds of good words in your vocabulary that you use every day, and they can do the exact same thing as a swear word did, because you can use perfectly good, nice words that you use every day to not edify, but to put down, and to not minister grace, but to be some kind of a curse to the person that you're speaking to. Okay, those are the eyes that look across and the eyes that look inward. What does this say about myself? As Susie acts in her little world here, does the things that she does, says the things that she says, what does that say about herself? And here is the idea of reputation. And students in the middle school levels, grade 7 and 8, they understand what reputation is. And I think we need to convey to them the idea that you are the one that is building that. And you as a teacher, you can't just snap your fingers and change that. And so we need to promote to them the idea of building their own reputation. And part of that is, have I earned a reputation of trust? What reputation is attached to my name? And so as this person acts, the eyes that look inward say, how do my actions reflect the true me? What do my actions say about myself? Galatians 6, 3-7 is a great passage. Well, I should say this. Galatians 6, 1-10 is a great passage. And being good conservative people who believe in community, we go there because we go there and bear each other's burdens and fulfill the law of Christ, and do good to those who are of the household of faith. And those verses are in this same passage here. But weaved right in between those great verses are verses that talk about our reputation, how that is built. Galatians 6:3. For if a man think himself to be something when he is nothing, he deceiveth himself. So he thinks about himself, and we do this too as teachers, and I see a caution right here. Paul is saying, you know what, there's an inherent danger when we think about ourselves, and the inherent danger is described in this verse, because when he thinks about himself, the danger is that there's going to be a self-inflated thinking about himself. A man thinks himself to be something. And so the danger of self evaluation is that it's a self-inflated evaluation. That's going to happen naturally, which is why you should encourage your older students to come to you for your account of them. Okay, they need to get a different perspective here on another evaluation of themselves other than just what they think about themselves. And so this is what I think, verse 3, but verse 4 is much more true to the reality of the situation. But let every man prove his own work, and then shall he have rejoicing in himself alone. Okay, you see the reputation coming through here. The reputation is being built after the proof is in the work, in his doing, in his actions. Then there's joy and rejoicing in his own reputation and not in another. And so this student is confident, not cocky. They understand that their reputation is built on the things that they do, the things that they say. They don't have to be a leech following others around, because they do have their own person and their own reputation, and that carries itself. And then in verse 5, for every man shall bear his own burden. And so there is a sense in which every student, every person, is personally responsible for their own reputation. And it's always going to be that way. And then in verse 7, be not deceived, God is not mocked, for whatsoever a man soweth, that shall he also reap. And the concept of sowing and reaping, we need to insert into our students' lives many times, often, as we bring them up through the school years. Now, it's natural for us and for our students to deny their harvest. They would rather, you know, if there's conflict with parents, there's trouble with teachers, there's trouble with other students, and they never seem to get their own way, you can tell that student, you know what, I think it has something to do with your record of sowing and reaping. Don't just deal with the reaping. You have to connect it back to the sowing. We have to connect the dots for them, because the natural sinful man is going to avoid that and skirt that fact that, you know what, I am simply reaping now what I sowed 10 minutes ago, 10 years ago, last class period, last recess, whatever was taking place. No farmer in his right mind denies his harvest. So if a farmer walks into his field at harvest time, he doesn't say, wow, I'm a good weed farmer. Or he doesn't walk out to his field and say, well, you know what, this isn't my field, I'm going to harvest the neighbor's field instead. He says, no, I did bad, okay? It's obvious, okay? Here's the fruit. It's a bunch of weeds, so what are we going to do with that poor yield? And the good thing is that we're teaching young people, and they have a lot more, they can look forward to many more harvests. And so we start looking at how can we make the next harvest look better. There's many more seasons ahead for them, and there's probably a lot more hope for them to change and bear a better harvest, maybe even than for us who are old and set in our own ways, and we think we have things figured out. And so the bright side here is that when we connect the reaping to the sowing, that we can make better plans for the next harvest. So to our students, we say, you know, as you live, what is the response to your actions from those above me, God, and those in authority above you, beside you? And how do your actions reflect on the true self within you? Now, I'll just pause here. Any comments or questions? This is the big picture. Now we want to go to the more detailed look that we use on our report cards. Comments or questions?
So you had mentioned like not letting it become a bragging fest, like where like, oh, you know, look how good I am and stuff. So how do you channel that instead of just saying, well, that's bragging, you don't brag? Is that the best approach for that? Or
so you have one that likes to brag, and you have another one that likes to call that one out for his bragging. Is that what you're saying?
Or like, should I call that out, shouldn't I? Like, the student doesn't have to do that. Like, as a teacher, it's probably my responsibility.
I think it depends on the age of the student. In my situation, I probably wouldn't make a deal of it in class. I'd take that student aside later when you have the time to look at this verse and say, you know what, Galatians 6:3, if a man thinks himself to be something when he is nothing, you know, Johnny, you need to think about the fact that when you're tempted to have a self-inflated view automatically, that's natural for you to do that. And actually, it's natural for everyone to do that. You need to watch that. And then he knows what you mean the next time it happens, and you look at him and you say, you know, remember? That would be my approach. The age of the student would play into whether you're coaching or disciplining. Okay, good question.
You make a difference. Do you differentiate between character and reputation? Talk about that.
I guess not really. To me, I mean, their character is what builds their reputation, would be my view of things. I didn't really go into deep, detailed definition of character. But
it is sometimes possible to have a reputation doesn't actually match the character.
That is true. Mm-hmm. Yes, that is true. And then they need to, in that case, it's probably their reputation, they're taking a reputation that's been imposed on them by others, and the others might need help in the way that they impose that, but that person also needs help to see that what's imposed on them is not true.
Well, I've thought about areas of reputation is what others say I am, and character is what I really am.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think that's where having an arsenal of a few verses to go back on, and you know, that person might have a certain reputation, but you know, when they speak, they really do build up and edify others. Having a few of these passages tucked away in our arsenal of things that we continually promote, it's not just Mr. Kurtz's word, then it's, you know, this is what God's word says about my actions. If this is how your character sizes up, this is what God says. It's not just me. Okay, let's go to the more specific. And I got plenty of these, so I'll just, the extras in the back, you can just pass them across to the rows that don't have enough, and pass the extras across to the chairs, empty chairs over there. Okay, so this is an exact copy of what I would use in talking to my 7th and 8th grade students. I might have handed out my notes. Oh, here they are. Good. Okay, so the left-hand column is what we've been talking about, the three-dimensional view of judgment. Eyes that look down, eyes that look across, and on the back, eyes that look inward. The second column, or the middle column, with the headings respect and honor, obedience and compliance, this column would be largely taken from the book that I referenced before, With All Due Respect by Ronald G. Moorish. We took a lot of his things directly. We cut some of them out, we revised some of them, and we added a few of our own. He had a section on conflict resolution, and out of that, I think we added the concept of community and peacemaking and non-resistance to that. So, looking at respect and honor, you'll see, the middle column is also what is on the back of the 7th and 8th grade report card at our school. And so what we ask our teachers to do is go down and give an assessment of the main headings here. So what does respect and honor look like? It looks like the four descriptors underneath, that they honor the place of leaders, they display respect for other students, they accept criticism, and show common courtesy. And so the teacher is asked to give some type of assessment on the respect and honor that this student displays. And so this is what I go over with my 7th and 8th graders, beginning of school, and sometimes usually halfway through the year again, as report card time comes out. We try to preach this and promote this to them. Don't just be thinking about your grades, be thinking about the backside of your report card. And it's been my experience that when parents get the report card, they glance at the front and they immediately flip it over to the back, okay? Because parents in our schools want a lot more than academics. And if we're there to serve them, to stand in their place, they're really interested in this kind of stuff. And I'm not saying that this is the best system. If you have a large school where it's hard to communicate teacher to every parent, I think this works well. If you're in a smaller setting where direct communication is easier, and you know it's a church school and you're with parents and back and forth a lot more, there's probably better ways of communicating this directly than just some mundane rating on a report card. And it behooves you as a teacher in any of, however you do this, to be honest. Okay, parents want you to be honest. You know, if it's a zero and they really lack, they want to know that. Okay, and they know their children better than you. Just trust me, they do. So they want to know the honest truth about how it's going at school, because they know for sure how it goes at home. Okay, so honor's a place of leaders. I tell my students it's not because they're always right, but because of their position. And so honor and respect has to do with honoring the person and their position. Displays respect for other students. All people are God's creation, God's handiwork, therefore deserving respect. And possibly this should fit down under the section Eyes That Look Across. But the idea of respect is obviously a school topic, and we need to promote that to our students, because we're all God's handiwork. And just because they think student so-so is a little odd, they need to remember they are God's creation. They accept criticism. Criticism and correction help us to grow. Mistakes are opportunities. And I think we need to promote that to our students. When things go wrong and the whole class is complaining, or you have a meltdown, okay, use it as an opportunity. Mistakes are opportunities. And shows common courtesy. Things like please and thank you. Just because polite people are nice to be around. Under obedience and compliance, a student honors the rules and encourages others to do the same. And so on the right side here, I try to promote to them, it's not just doing what is right, but it's promoting what is right. Because you can have the student who would never do anything wrong, especially if they're going to get caught for it, but that situation might change or be different if they know that the teacher's out of sight or they can get away with it. Okay, so there's a difference between doing what is right and promoting what is right. And we need to help them to distinguish that. Complies without excessive supervision. Does not need to be told every little thing to do or not to do. They're guided by their conscience. They obey immediately without complaining. And so we talk about delayed obedience is really disobedience, because the disobedience is in the delay. And if you're blessed to be a parent, you understand that, you know, the delay is the disobedience, okay, because they're testing. They're waiting to see if you really meant what you said. And then obeying with complaining is disobedience. And so I've had my students in the wilderness with the Israelites many times, because almost guaranteed you will come up against complaining. And if it's a plague, stop and take the time to show them what complaining really does and how long you really have to wander in the wilderness just for complaining. And are they honest? Trust is always a huge issue, and this goes back to the idea of a reputation as well. A reputation of honesty is what builds trust. Then the two sections that deal with response to others, conflict, resolution, and peacemaking. We have Romans 14:19 listed as the verse here. Puts self in the shoes of others, as in literally applies the golden rule. And so what you said is not as important as how it was heard. Maybe this is more reflecting on Ephesians 4:29 now. But to our students, it's not what you said or what you did, but how did the other person receive it? And so we need to help them to think about the impact of their actions on others. Avoids conflicts if possible, and does not stir up unnecessary conflict. They're able to let conflict go. And then analyzes situations where there is conflict, which students do not naturally do, especially 7th and 8th graders. When there's conflict, it's knee-jerk responses, okay? And so we have to teach them to be thoughtful and to actually take a calculated response rather than just a knee-jerk reaction to the conflict that's happening around them. Okay, you need to actually stop and think in these situations what you're going to do, or you're going to get yourself into big trouble. And all you have to do is pick up the daily news and you can find, you know, people that got in trouble. They were in crime because they were with so-and-so, and you know what I mean. Seeks ways to resolve conflict. They desire resolution and work towards a resolution when there is conflict. And so the idea here is that they actually desire the resolution. There are some students that will make resolution because you said we have to, you know, we have to clear this up. But do they actually desire that there's resolution to the conflict that they created or that they're a part of? And then demonstrates non-resistance, does not retaliate or hold grudges. They have a Jesus-like response when wrongdoing is done to them. And then cooperation and community. We have Romans 12:10 here. Be kindly affectioned one to another in brotherly love and honor, preferring one another. Cooperation and community. Do they work well in groups? Are they a team player, not a one-man show? Are they a team player, not a one-man show? They think of others before themselves. Very simple, but good. Other focused is humble servanthood. Those who are others focused have a humble and a servanthood attitude. Those who are me focused are proud and self-serving. And we saw the ones that receive God's blessing and God's grace in their lives are the humble, and those who receive his resistance are the proud. Are we willing to serve others rather than have others serve him or her? Just like Jesus, he came to serve, not to be served. And I think we can promote to our students, I know we can promote to our students a mission of the Master. Jesus came to serve, not to be served, and to give his life a ransom for many. And does not interfere with the work of others. Don't hinder others from success. Moving on to the back, participation and involvement. Three categories that we've listed under response to self. The eyes that look inward. What does this say about me? What do my actions say about me? Can develop and present informed opinions. Can back up belief statements. Can clearly state personal ideas and thoughts. So this is much more maybe academic in nature, but can they say why, or as I talk to my students, can you say why you think what you think? Don't just run at the mouth and say whatever comes to mind. Think logically and speak logically. We need to actually help them to do that. That won't come naturally. Or the logic that does come naturally is twisted and warped. And you understand that. Are they alert and attentive in class? They show a desire to learn. And the desire to learn is something only... Okay, you can help them create that desire, but that desire really is their own. They need to produce that. And focuses on teacher, not distractions in the classroom. Are they able to focus on the important and tune out the unimportant? And then responsibility and organization. I had one teacher who just nailed this section because she was very organized and responsible. And she would tally. She could say why she gave every student the mark that she did, because this person forgot their pen 4 times in the last quarter, and they didn't have, you know, this book this many times. And she had it all tracked out. So that might be a little bit to the extreme, but she could truly say why she put what she put on this section of the report card. And it was helpful. It was revealing to think that a student could forget something as common as a pen 16 times in a 44-day quarter. And that's pretty amazing. Okay, so they need very few reminders. The more responsible you are, the less reminders are needed. So we talk about inverse relationships. In math class, you can promote this as an inverse relationship. The more responsible you are, the less reminders you need. They're prepared for school, the school day, and individual classes. Readiness for school will be reflected in readiness for church, work, and other events in life. That's why it's important that you give an accurate report to the parents. If they're always late for class, what are the chances that they're going to always be late for work? Okay? It carries over into other parts of life. Organizes self and work, has a plan and works the plan. They don't just have a plan, they work the plan. They plan ahead and schedule work effectively. And of course, failure to plan is planning to fail, as Benjamin Franklin said. They self-evaluate previous choices and outcomes. They learn from previous successes and mistakes. They connect the dots. This is really the law of sowing and reaping here. And again, they need you as a teacher to help them connect those dots. Okay, can you see, Sammy, how your previous choices led to this outcome? Help them connect the dots. Can they be trusted to complete a task that is not teacher supervised? In other words, what happens when the teacher leaves study hall? You might as well talk about that at the beginning of school when you give this speech rather than deal with it after you have to leave study hall for the first time. Okay? Something will happen. Okay? If you prime them for what should happen, then they know what they should be doing. Self-discipline and diligence. So for a 7th and 8th grade student, Ronald Morish says they should be able to maintain their behavior for 40 minutes without direct supervision. And so what I tell my students is that this means that you are capable of working all study hall without any correction from the supervisor. Study hall is 40 minutes, and everyone believes that you can work for 40 minutes without getting yourself or others in trouble. That should be able to be expected. And if you haven't learned yet, no talking study hall is the only way to go, or you'll fight it. There's no solution. It's just the way it is. And they can work until the task is completed or the time limit is reached. They persevere to the finish, and they can work according to level of ability. They do their best. They don't just look for the easy road, and they're okay with others who succeed beyond them. And so working according to level of ability, we really do need to take this into consideration. There are students of great character who work very diligently, and they get a C. And there are students who get an A without trying, and if they think that A somehow, you know, makes them better, they really need some work, too, on their character. They need to be prompted and promoted to really achieve according to their level of ability. Maybe it's not a 93A, maybe it's a 97A that they need to be pushed towards. Okay, so this is simply what's on our 7th and 8th grade report card. It starts out at a kindergarten level. It's a shortened list, and then it just grows from that point on. If any of you want the full list, I can email it to you. Just email me, and I can email the whole list back to you as we revised it from this book. My email is a long one. It's lyle.musser@shalommennoniteschool.com. That's all spelled out. SMS was taken as the domain name or whatever. So it's lyle.musser@shalommennoniteschool.com. Okay. I don't have time to go over this in detail, but for a chapel, I started looking into, well, I had reason to look into the law, and that got me looking into, you know, how does our society actually look at wrongdoing and all of that? And so I got into the New Jersey law, which is what came up on the internet as I was searching this. And it was very interesting to me that our judicial system out there in the world takes into account this arrow right here, the eyes that look inward, and the degrees of crime that are committed have to do with this arrow right here. They have to do with the intent of the heart. And so this is from the New Jersey law. First degree crimes are described as intentional, willful, and premeditated, and they call it with malice aforethought. And so there was an intent to commit an unlawful act. So first degree crimes are planned in detail in advance. So the example here is a person who goes to a particular place to meet a particular person to do a particular thing. That's a first degree crime. It was obviously planned out, and the intent was there. Second degree crimes are intentional but not premeditated. Okay, they intentionally, willfully did them, but it wasn't premeditated or planned in advance. And so this is still called with malice aforethought, and it was not planned, but it's what happened because of the circumstances of wrongdoing. So the example here would be three men go to rob a bank, and they have no intention of harming anyone in the bank. But as they're robbing the bank, in the heat of that moment, one of the robbers punches a bank worker, knocks him out cold, or pulls a gun, and we have a murder. Guess what happens here? It's not just the one who used the gun. So all three men are guilty of a second degree crime, not just the one who used the gun, because they were all involved with the malice aforethought, which was to rob the bank, not to murder the bank worker. The malice aforethought was to rob the bank, which makes all three of them guilty of the murder. Does that make sense? That's a great analogy for students that get in trouble for being who they're with. Okay? You can tell them that's how it'll work when you're in the courtroom. Okay, third degree crimes are sometimes called voluntary crimes or crimes of passion because they are unintentional but committed under circumstances that would cause a reasonable person to become angry or upset. That's right from the law there. Would cause a reasonable person to become angry or upset. And so it's not planned or thought about at all, but in the heat of the moment, when irritated by others, a person commits a crime. And so, for example, a man finds out that his wife is disloyal to him, and she proudly announces that she's going to move out and marry another man. In the heat of that moment, he gets angry and hits her so that she is injured. That would be a third degree crime. And then there are involuntary crimes where there's no intent at all to harm someone, such as you're driving down the road and a wheel flies off your car and hits somebody else and hurts them. That's an involuntary crime, and that's in a completely different category. So in the New Jersey law, first degree crimes are described as having a 10 to 20 year sentence with a $200,000 fine. Second degree crimes are 5 to 10 years with a $150,000 fine. Third degree crimes are 3 to 5 years with a $15,000 crime. So it's just very interesting to me how our law system out there, even the world, recognizes this concept of where the wrongdoing came from, and the punishment is then scaled to meet that evil intent. Okay, there's much more that we could say. Our time is about up. So in conclusion, my actions, all of my actions, are looked at from three angles, from three sets of eyes, from three perspectives. God is really the one who knows all three perspectives perfectly, and therefore he makes the perfect judge of our actions, or he makes a perfect judgment on our actions. Ask him what he thinks about your actions and listen to what he says. Again, the best thing we can do is promote to our students that God is looking, seeing, assessing, and God pays for fruit. God pays the best for good fruit. And so what kind of fruit are you producing? What kind of fruit are your students producing? And are you encouraging them, edifying them, building them up when you see that good fruit? Sometimes we can always look at the bad, identify the bad, but don't forget to miss the good, because we are under the obligation as well to edify and build up and minister grace. Okay, any last comments quickly? I don't want to keep you from getting to the next session.
Do you have any practical pointers for when you're grading 12 to 20 students on the back of the card and you're sort of full of blanks that you want to put down?
You're like me. You get to the end of the quarter and you didn't think about it yet, which is why my teacher that tracked everything, there was a certain element of that impressed me. I think for me, it's why I concluded that I need to go over this with my students on a regular basis. It's as much a reminder for me to be looking for it as it is for them to be trying to produce this type of character in their lives. I don't have a good solution, because I'm like you. I get to the end of the quarter and do the grand summary and pull a number out of the hat and give that assignment. Maybe someone else has a better way.
Is that what you use, a number scale?
We do a number scale, yeah. Okay, well, thank you for your time and attention. Hopefully it's something you can use and be a blessing.
For more free resources that support teaching and learning, visit thedocforlearning.org.